Psychedelics are powerful psychoactive substances that exist throughout the natural world. And while they may hold significant potential for our understanding of the mind, they remain illegal in many countries, and ever since the 1960s have been a continued subject of controversy, intrigue, and misinformation. In recent years, however, some of the initial hysteria around these substances has died down, and a new generation of scientists has begun returning to this area and attempting to understand these mysterious compounds, their potential psychotherapeutic value, what they might tell us about the deep structure of our minds, and, according to some, including my guest today, what they might tell us about the nature of reality. Hi everyone, welcome back to Waking Cosmos, a philosophy podcast hosted by me, Adrian Nelson, focusing on the mystery of consciousness and its place in reality. Today I'm joined by the psychologist David Luke, who is one of a small number of researchers who are legally studying psychedelics here in the UK. One of the things that really stands out to me about David, which I really admire, is that while he is taking this very scientific approach to understanding psychedelics, he keeps an open mind about what the psychedelic state might bring us into contact with. As a past president of the Parapsychological Association, David is also quite uniquely placed to discuss some of the stranger, apparently extended mind phenomena associated with the psychedelic experience, such as perceived cases of telepathy and precognition. And he's actually been involved in a number of experiments in this area. I'm really looking forward to sharing this conversation with you. Just before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank those of you who are supporting the podcast on Patreon. Without your help, none of this would exist, and so thank you. I really appreciate you seeing some value in what I'm doing. It really means a lot. For those of you who are enjoying the podcast but are not yet supporting it, I do still have quite a way to go before this becomes something that I can afford to do full time, which is something that I would love to be able to do. So if you would like to support me on this project and help me reach my goal of sustainability, the link to my Patreon page is in the description, and of course, all Patreon supporters get early access to the podcast as soon as I finish editing it. Thank you. Okay, without further delay, I give you the psychologist, David Luke. Hi, David. Thank you for joining me for this conversation. How are you doing?
Hi, Adrian. Yes, I'm pretty good, thanks. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Really great to have you. And I have to say, I really admire your open-minded approach to this subject of psychedelics. And it's very refreshing and interesting to hear you talk about this subject. Today, we are going to talk about your research with psychedelics. So perhaps I should start off by asking you what it is about these substances that you find so interesting and important to explore.
So they are, I mean, extraordinary tools for altering one's consciousness, and it's the kind of experiences and phenomena that comes out of those psychedelic experiences that I'm most intrigued by, what we might call the transpersonal experiences or exceptional human experiences, and what we can learn about the nature of reality and the nature of consciousness from exploring those kinds of experiences in particular. But I am interested in all states of consciousness. Just my particular avenue I'm looking down is primarily psychedelic.
To me, what seems so initially interesting and potentially valuable about psychedelics is that they essentially bring the usually unconscious mind into consciousness. And so just as a tool in that capacity, there seems to be like a huge amount of potential for understanding the deep structure of our minds and how they're organized, especially since, you know, so much of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis essentially is based around teasing out unconscious material that people need to work through and process.
Yeah, very much so. Freud or Jung, I can't remember which one, said that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Then, you know, psychedelics are a kind of an imperial highway or something. I mean, obviously, you have to first of all believe in the nature of the unconscious, not just discredit it as somehow being total nonsense. Which I think is a somewhat kind of myopic view. But I think, yeah, certainly what lurks within our unconscious is of huge potential, not just within the therapeutic context, but also for a personal development context in terms of what we can learn about ourselves and who we are and the kind of myth stories that guide us and make us do all the things that we do. But it's also a rich seam of accessing states which may be conducive to creativity and problem solving as well. So there's a lot to kind of to mine and to learn and to gain from exploring the unconscious through altered states, be it psychedelic or dreams or whatever, really. So I happen to agree with you.
Good. Yeah, I have always found it surprising that Jung, as far as I know, never really wrote very much about psychedelics, especially given how fascinated he was with the unconscious. But and maybe that just wasn't appropriate at the time.
Yeah, I think his response was to people who had invited him to take psychedelics. And he was kind of, you know, in his older years when psychedelics started appearing on the scene, he said he had enough work to do trying to understand the mind through dreams, and that he had a lifetime of work there. So he didn't want to just kind of open up the Pandora's box any further and then delve into psychedelics as well.
How do researchers like you think about these very highly meaningful and even mystical experiences that people have with psychedelics? Is it possible, do you think, to talk about mystical experiences in a scientific way?
Yes, I think it's possible to talk about anything in a scientific way. It kind of depends on your prior assumptions and how you approach the subject matter. Obviously, we're delving into the realms of subjective experience, which, you know, was taboo within the realms of psychology for many, many years and is now coming back into vogue, and particularly through the lens of neuroscience. And I think it is possible and valuable to consider the mystical experience and other subjective experiences. Trying to quantify it is difficult. Trying to understand it is probably more difficult from a scientific perspective, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't look at it, really. And particularly what is quite salient as well is what we're finding from a lot of the psychedelic clinical research is that those people who tend to have mystical experiences during their psychedelic trips are those that have better clinical outcomes. So they are more likely to give up smoking if it's a nicotine addiction study, or they're more likely to have a more profound reduction in their fear of death and consequently have reduced depression, anxiety, and also need for medication as they near the end of life if they have a terminal illness or something like that. So the mystical experience is not only just a kind of a scientific enigma that kind of deserves exploring, but it also has a clinical benefit, it would seem. So we should be looking to understand it as much as we can from a scientific perspective.
So in terms of seeing some of these potential positive outcomes from taking psychedelics, how important is it to have a mystical experience? Because it doesn't always happen, right?
No, it doesn't always happen. The kind of mystical experience can be, you know, teased out some more through appropriate set and setting, as we discovered, you know, in various research over the years, that if you take people who are already spiritual practitioners and you put them in a conducive environment, they probably have a better chance of having a mystical experience. But its benefits are apparent in that it increases kind of clinical outcomes, like positive clinical outcomes. But also, I think it's possible to have beneficial psychedelic experiences which can help with, you know, depression, anxiety, or addictions, or end of life anxiety, whatever it may be, without having a mystical experience. But it seems that those who do greatly benefit from it. So how do we understand that from a scientific perspective is a curious notion. It suggests to me that it's something far more than just a pharmacological action in the brain, which a lot of my neuroscientific colleagues are want to kind of try and understand, you know, the underlying chemical mechanisms and neurobiological mechanisms, but that the psychological content of your experience bears a great relationship to your kind of outcome suggests that the psychological factors are also quite key, especially when issues around set and setting, i.e. what's your psychological framework when you come to the situation and what's the context in which you take them, they also seem to have an effect on the kind of experience you have. So it really is a kind of at the crossroads, a fusion of pharmacology and psychology. And of course, being a psychologist, I'm more interested in the psychological components of that.
Yeah. And so people do have these occasionally very enlightening experiences through these substances. I suppose the question that we're left with is, does that actually lead to more enlightened behavior after the experience in terms of their ethics and their outlook on the world?
So some of the research, particularly that coming out of John Hopkins University, where they've been particularly engaged with these kinds of questions, they did find kind of positive changes to one's personality following a mystical experience, more so than compared to those who didn't have what they decided was a full-blown mystical experience. So they found that basically people were just nicer or easier to get along with or more positive or more productive. And that wasn't just gauged by the people themselves, but also by their family and their peers and their work colleagues who were invited to kind of give independent ratings of the person's kind of general personality after the experience. And we found that that was kind of very heavily related to the occasion of the mystical experience. So there would seem to be, you know, evidence to suggest that having one of these experiences really does change you or have benefits to the personality. For instance, openness to experience is one of these wonderful psychological constructs related to how interested you are to engage in kind of cultural activities or more likely to try novel things, food or entertainments or whatever, and is also strongly linked to creativity. That was seen to increase quite significantly among those who'd had a mystical experience. And it's used to be thought that, well, it is kind of generally considered that beyond the age of 30, we don't see huge shifts in people's personality, except for in extremely life-changing situations like marriage or divorce or the death of a spouse and things like that, which are usually positive for women and negative for men for some unknown reason. But we do see these dramatic changes in openness to experience following mystical experiences through psychedelics. So it has the capacity to make profound changes in people's personality at a point where changes in personality don't tend to occur.
That's fascinating. I want to sort of get into eventually the ways that you think about the psychedelic experience and how it might help us to think about consciousness, maybe. But I think maybe we should start out by stating, just for the record, that psychedelics in this country are, of course, illegal. So we can't strictly advocate that people seek out these experiences. And not necessarily just for legal reasons. There is some risk of sustaining psychological trauma when we consume these substances, especially if we're not prepared entirely for what might happen. So they're not risk-free, and yet there does seem to be a certain degree of misplaced fear perhaps around psychedelics as well. So David, how have you gotten around the laws in order to study these substances legally?
Well, I don't try to get around the laws as such as work within it. So most of my research has, a lot of it's been through surveys, just merely just kind of asking people, you know, what drugs they've taken, what kind of experiences they've had. I've also conducted field research, which I'm currently also doing. Most of it previously was in South America, where these substances are kind of widely and openly and legally used, and also in Central America as well. But also currently I'm doing field research with DMT, with psychonauts, but in a way in which we protect their identity and anonymity, etc., so that we're not putting anybody at risk. But also I've had the opportunity to collaborate with other researchers who are administering psychedelics within laboratory and also hospital settings, primarily with LSD. So a bit of a mixed bag, really, but always within the confines of the legal framework. So it is possible to do this. It's just you have to be a bit more ingenious about how you go about collecting this data.
Yeah, I know that I personally feel like I should be fairly cautious about discussing any experiences that I might have had with psychedelics. And so I wonder how you approach having an open public conversation about maybe your own experiences, given the laws exist as they do. Is that a bit of a minefield?
Potentially. I don't have too much concern about it. I mean, I've taken various psychedelics in the course of my research. I've been a test subject in various other psychedelic research as well. So, you know, I've been injected with DMT and psilocybin and MDMA in the laboratory. And I've partaken of numerous psychedelics in Central and South America with typically with indigenous people, but also with churches and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I have enough experiences personally within the kind of legal frame that I don't really have to worry too much about feeling I have to justify my actions particularly.
Fair enough, yeah. I know, you know, psychedelics have got quite a complicated history with the war on drugs and the antics of Timothy Leary in the 60s, but maybe this sounds a bit conspiratorial, but I do sometimes wonder if an additional factor for why psychedelics are illegal is because they can lead to these dramatic shifts in perspective, which shine sometimes quite a critical light on our society in some ways and our collective behaviour. And, you know, perhaps authorities of various kinds would rather we didn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we look historically to what was happening in the States in the 60s, you know, there was a kind of governmental and media hysteria in reaction to, you know, the very sharp and controversial and challenging rise of the hippie movement. And not just that, but, you know, human potential movement in general, which was also aligned to a kind of more general counterculture, which was also associated with anti-war protesting and Black Liberation Movement and so on and so forth. So it became an easy way of criminalizing sections of society who may be seen to be somewhat problematic for the government. And I think, you know, the reasons for criminalizing these drugs are not really well founded. It primarily was cultural and historical prejudice rather than well-reasoned scientific evidence. And we should have learned really from the era of alcohol prohibition a few decades earlier in the States, whereby prohibiting the use of alcohol just gave rise to various you know, mafias and gangs and so on and so forth that took control of the supply and demand of these substances. And, you know, when you make something prohibited, you drive it underground and it's no longer a controlled substance, despite the name of the law that governs it, you know, Controlled Substances Act and so on, that they become out of control. They become subject to the black market. So it, you know, the reasons for it are historical, really. If you look at the evidence now, there doesn't seem to be much good reason to maintain those kind of prohibitions. In my opinion, prohibition typically seems to cause more problems than it solves. And a lot of countries are now moving towards decriminalization of various substances because it just makes more kind of social and economic sense as well. But I could spend all day talking about that, no doubt.
Yeah, I do think that there is this important sense in which we're not truly free if the society that we're living in doesn't actually allow us to explore the space of our own minds in a peaceful way, even as adults. And, you know, especially since so much of what we are is our mind in a way. And, you know, I'm sure that's been said many times, but that to me does seem like an error. So what do you think about that? Would a more advanced society legalize psychedelics?
Yeah, I think, if you're going to look at this in the context, they've only been kind of illegal for like 50 odd years or something. I mean, and also the terminology here, the substances themselves aren't illegal. It's their use, technically, which is illegal. I just have to put that in there because a lawyer friend of mine keeps banging on about this all the time. There you go, Daryl. And but I think, yeah, I mean, it's about self-sovereignty and cognitive liberties, really. I think that's what it boils down to, that we should have the right to decide what we ingest and what we put into our body and how we affect our mind and consciousness. I believe that's a kind of fundamental right, really. Obviously, we have to kind of be cautious against harms, you know, like minors or children or people who are vulnerable and all the rest of it. But that becomes an issue of education and medicine, really, rather than a legal issue. Or at least there should be more room for the medical and educational kind of dimensions of this discussion. They're kind of taken out of the whole equation through the whole kind of prohibition rhetoric, really. But I think things are slowly starting to change. In fact, quite quickly starting to change. You know, as you're probably aware of what's happening with cannabis in the States, and the rest of the world are also decriminalizing various substances at quite a rapid rate. We've also seen that psilocybin has just received a fast track kind of authorization for potential licensing as a medicament based on the evidence coming out for its use in treating depression. So we could see decriminalization or at least recategorization of a lot of these substances in the coming years. I think there's very good arguments for that as well. If you treat it like perhaps like even on the recreational front, you know, ignoring for a minute the kind of potential medical benefits of these substances, if people wanted to take these things, you could consider it like a kind of dangerous sport. You know, we don't criminalize dangerous sports, and yet people partake of them all the time. But then you wouldn't go out and just buy a hang glider and jump off the top of a cliff. You would join a club. You'd find out how, you know, get a license maybe to fly, work out how to use it, you know, speak to people. You'd be kind of trained and shown how to kind of operate this thing in a relatively safe way, so that when you do begin to kind of just fly solo, you're fully prepared to do that. So, you know, there's no reason why we couldn't have, you know, psychedelic sports clubs, for instance, you know, but not necessarily sports, but, you know, they could be for one's own personal exploration. So that model should equally apply. And in fact, you know, David Nutt, who is the drug czar in this country, was basically sacked by the government for not giving them the answers they wanted. And when he came out and said that actually ecstasy, MDMA, is less dangerous than equacy, which is what he referred to as horse riding. So statistically, you know, the hours spent horse riding is more dangerous than hours spent taking MDMA. And yet we don't make horse riding illegal, right? There's a certain amount of hypocrisy and nonsensicality around drugs, because they've historically been this kind of issue of that generates a lot of hysteria. Just to finish with a quote, I think it was Timothy Leary, although I'm not entirely sure, he says, you know, psychedelics are these extraordinary substances which can cause hysteria in people who've never even taken them, which is a great line, I think.
Yeah, that was Timothy Leary, as far as I know. So I've noticed in various places in your work and in your online lectures that you seem quite open to the possibility that consciousness or mind in some way could be fundamental to reality, which is a view that I'm quite sympathetic with as well. Would you say for you that it is the psychedelic experience itself that leads you to this, or are there other philosophical reasons, for example, which point in this direction for you?
Yeah, I mean, I come at it kind of both experientially and kind of intellectually, academically. I'm not hugely well versed in philosophy of mind. I mean, you know, I'm a bit of a dabbler. But I find materialism or materialist reductionism, physicalism, those kind of explanations of ontology, the nature of reality and the mind-body problem, somewhat unsatisfactory. I think idealism, which you're talking about, or perhaps even dualism, are also somewhat unsatisfactory in that there is no one good explanation of the relationship between mind and body as I can see it. So I try to remain agnostic, which is, I think, is a stance that, you know, scientists would do well to practice. You know, the whole endeavor of science is supposed to be open-minded, and yet it comes front-loaded with so many assumptions and priors and actual beliefs that it operates in a way which just kind of bootstraps itself by just supporting the mainstream perspective of materialist reductionism. And yet I think there's a lot of evidence which would run counter to that, which kind of suggests that consciousness can extend beyond the brain. And I don't just mean the human nervous system or the gut or whatever, you know, but beyond the actual physical body. And I think we need to take that evidence seriously and view the data kind of impartially and agnostically. I don't have a particular philosophical position. I'm also sympathetic to idealism, possible dualism, or even materialism to some extent, but I don't find any of those kind of approaches satisfactory particularly. I think the problems with dualism and idealism is they don't have very good theoretical basis, but the data certainly is somewhat supportive of them. Whereas with materialism, most of the data fits materialism, but a lot of it is anomalous to it. But it does have, a better kind of theoretical kind of stronghold on the situation. You know, it's easy to explain everything in terms of materialism, so long as you reject all the evidence which contradicts it. You know,
including the existence of consciousness.
Yeah, including the existence of consciousness by some definitions. Yes, indeed. Which, you know, is clearly very unsatisfactory. So I don't know if we'll ever will fully understand consciousness. Maybe our own consciousness isn't kind of advanced enough to be capable to understand itself, which is a kind of mysterianism kind of perspective, which I have some sympathy with as well, you know. But certainly the current mainstream thinking on thinking is inadequate, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the issues is that there's a lot of scientists out there that aren't necessarily aware that there are actually these quite plausible philosophical arguments for panpsychism, for example, or views in which mind could be intrinsic to the universe. All of that tends to get lumped in with sort of the New Age or loosely thinking sort of frames. And yet there are quite serious philosophers who think actually this is the most plausible explanation for the mind-body question, is that, yeah, perhaps consciousness or interiority is fundamental in some way. And but relating this back to psychedelics, and one of the things that is baffling about psychedelics is that there seems to be so much going on in the mind, and yet, as you know, brain imaging seems to show quite surprisingly that the brain itself under these states seems to be in large part, or in a general way, quieter than usual. And this does seem to be at least somewhat consistent with the reducing valve view of the brain, and well, the idea that the brain is more like a receiver of consciousness rather than the generator of it. And I know that you've mentioned that. Can you talk about this a bit?
Yeah, I think on the surface of it, at least, I mean, Huxley's notion of the brain as a reducing valve, you know, he put this idea out there in the 1950s, and it borrowed heavily from the thinking of Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, that, you know, the brain is not so much a producer of consciousness, rather a filter of it. It's this kind of filter theory of consciousness. And his ideas, you know, didn't really go much further than that. They're never really kind of put to the test. He certainly applied psychedelics to that. He said, you know, psychedelics are able to turn off this filter mechanism of the brain. So thereby you turn off the reducing valve or turn it down, and your mind becomes flooded with this kind of wealth of conscious experience of, you know, cosmic consciousness or mystical or psychical states of being. And that wasn't really kind of put to the test particularly. But then there was this interesting evidence, perhaps you could interpret it in that context, which came out in 2012 from the lab here in London, that they found that actually, counter to what everybody had probably predicted would happen, when they did some brain imaging of people on psilocybin, they found there was no increase in brain activity anywhere in the brain, in fact. And there was kind of significant reductions in this area of called the default mode network, which they kind of link somewhat to your kind of ego control mechanism, if you like. Now, it's a bit more complex than that. And I think that certainly revived interest in this kind of filter theory and Huxley's notions of what happens under the influence of psychedelics. But the actual image is, the actual picture is more complex than that, because what also happens in the brain, although there's no increase in activity, there are increases in connectivity. So the brain is quieter, but it's also more diffuse. There's a greater amount of what my colleagues might call entropy, which I think is a kind of a somewhat freighted term based on the implications. There is more kind of or even chaotic interactions in the brain. It switches the brain from operating under its normal constraints to working in a more unconstrained way and having communication between disparate parts of the brain. So that, you know, it could be argued either way. I think my neuroscientific colleagues would say, oh, it's the kind of experiences are more due to this hyperconnectivity in the brain rather than the actual generalized brain reductions in activity. So I think the jury's still out and it's early days, but I think there's some interesting things going on. What is so fascinating is that when we genuinely start to look at psychedelics from a kind of psychological and neurobiological perspective, we're kind of forced to actively engage with some of the bizarre phenomena that occurs in these states, like experiences of shared consciousness or precognition or psi experiences, encounters with other sentient beings and so on and so forth, which deserve genuine attention, you know.
Definitely. And I do want to get into that shortly. But just to finish this comment on the default mode network and that being lower in activity, I mean, what I do know of the default mode network in the brain, which is admittedly not a lot, but it is quite closely associated with our sense of ego or our sense of being an embodied self. And so I could imagine that if activity there is inhibited, then an apparent transpersonal experience could occur as a result of that region no longer acting as this kind of partition between our usual bodily sense of self and everything else in our field of experience. And so essentially opening us up to identifying self with everything. And so you could imagine potentially if activity went down in this area, and perhaps that would lead to a much greater apparent content of consciousness, even if the overall brain activity is lowered. Is that an explanation that could be plausible?
Yeah, I think that's very plausible. And I think it's still very much open debate, you know, and I think it fits a kind of transpersonal understanding of the nature of consciousness as much as it baffles and drives neuroscientists to try and interpret and understand the data. I think it's too early to say, but I think there's certainly it was intriguing. And I think somewhat exciting that, the first kind of real data on this seem to suggest a reduction of activity, generally speaking, which very much ties in with what Huxley said. He was certainly correct in one aspect. Had there been an increase in brain activity, as everyone had predicted, then we could just ignore Huxley's from the get-go. But I think it gives us the opportunity to kind of explore these more transpersonal notions of consciousness with the brain data. I mean, we find similar things as well with people in other states. So we find the same kind of pattern of activity with meditation, with ayahuasca as well, with deep states of hypnosis, and even with mediums. So people, psychographers, experienced psychographers, these are people who go into a trance and then they just let their hand with a pen just write freely, and they supposedly kind of write whole tracts of even whole books, supposedly authored by people who are dead. This is a kind of very common practice in Brazil. And when they put inexperienced and experienced psychographers in the fMRI, they found that, you know, the inexperienced psychographers tended to have an increase in brain activity, consistent with kind of, you know, trying to do something, whereas the experienced psychographers had this whole reduction in their default mode network, suggesting that their kind of ego activity of the brain was kind of tuned down as consistent with, you know, going into a trance state. So, you know, the data is consistent with kind of transpersonal considerations of the data as well, but I wouldn't say it's conclusive.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Why do you think it is that psychedelics experiences make deeper views of consciousness, such as idealism and panpsychism, and even, maybe even animism, seem so much more plausible to the experiencer?
Well, I mean, if you look at the kind of psychology of belief, the biggest driver of belief is usually experience. Okay, you know, you can, especially like in the field of parapsychology, you know, which I work in, no amount of data typically convinces many people. People have their beliefs and they're very much kind of stick to them, and they'll just, you know, selectively filter whatever information fits or doesn't fit their existing beliefs. However, experience seems to be the largest driver of belief. So, you know, people who tend to have anomalous or transpersonal experiences, that will shift their worldview if they you know, have a worldview prior to that which doesn't fit in. So there's some recent data coming out of John Hopkins, and they've found that, you know, DMT changed the kind of belief system even of atheists, a substantial percentage, not the whole lot, but just, you know, taking DMT, a large number of atheists stopped being atheists after their DMT experience. Because experience drives our beliefs, really. You know, we have cognitive dissonance between what we're told we're meant to believe and our experience of reality or of consciousness. Typically, people may wrestle with those experiences and ultimately may be baffled or agnostic or come out with a more spiritually orientated worldview or panpsychic or animistic or whatever. So I think psychedelics have a great capacity for shifting worldviews, for changing perspectives through the experience, not necessarily through the brain imaging data or any amount of experiments that are conducted, because our experience is our reality, ultimately.
Yeah. And just relating this slightly back to the default mode network, I think if they're, you know, activity in the default mode network is going down, and so our sense of ego is dissolved in a way, and yet the brain is still clearly conscious in these states and in these very unique and novel ways, then that sense of a very profound consciousness without any discernible self could be, you know, lead to experiences of universal consciousness and oneness, which may not be connected directly to the truth of that statement, and yet it provides a perspective in which that could be true.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of kind of argument and discussion at the moment about kind of ego dissolution and what that actually means. What do we mean by ego, and what do we mean by ego dissolution, and so on and so forth, particularly in the psychedelic research arena, because it means different things to different people. But certainly, you know, experiences of unity consciousness and encounters with an other, you know, which people perceive to be sentient or real, or, you know, transpersonal experiences whereby a profound connection to nature or telepathic experiences with other people, those kind of experiences, which, yeah, certainly could be driven by reductions in default mode activity, are quite paramount. And regardless of how we define ego and ego dissolution, which is, you know, kind of a highly debatable subject right now.
Yeah. For me, there is this intuition that, given that I think that there is a good chance that consciousness is fundamental to reality in some way, based on philosophical convictions that I have. And if that's the case, then, you know, it does seem perhaps more reasonable to consider that through direct contemplation on the nature of consciousness, there could be potential sources for information about the deep structure of reality in some way. And so perhaps this contemplative inner approach is kind of what's missing from materialism in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's taken a kind of very black box approach to the nature of experience, which is somewhat kind of limiting. Yeah, I think it would behoove scientists and neuroscientists and researchers of consciousness to be more experiential, to study and practice, you know, Buddhism or yoga or lucid dreaming, all of these kinds of things, to at least begin to kind of verify supposedly what their positions are, you know, from a first person perspective. You know, it's an intriguing thing. Our kind of experience is our reality, as I said, but we also, it's driven by our beliefs and our perceptions. So if we have certain prior beliefs that, you know, mind is actually just brain, or the brain produces consciousness, or brain's just, or consciousness is just a kind of epiphenomena or illusion even, our belief system is going to kind of constrain the kind of perceptions that we can have that would offer evidence to the contrary, whereby if you take a first person perspective, be a bit more agnostic and see what actually arises, and look at the issue from both the inside and the outside, you may give you some more challenging perspectives on the nature of consciousness and reality. So we need to keep an open mind, but not so much our brains fall out.
Right. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts about the idea that psychedelics played a role in human evolution, or the evolution of our minds in some way. Are you open to that view?
Yeah, I think it's worth considering, certainly. I mean, this kind of harkens to Terence McKenna's, you know, stoned ape theory, where, you know, he put forward this idea that our ancient ancestors on the savannas of Africa, probably looking for foodstuffs, stumbled across mushrooms, you know, magic mushrooms, and consumed them, and had a kind of leap in their kind of conscious experience, which drove their kind of evolution of their brain and mind, perhaps through some kind of synesthesia experience, whereby in a pre-linguistic human ancestor, they may not have had the capacity to name things. And then, you know, perhaps you have an experience of synesthesia, and sounds become visual objects, which happens very commonly. In fact, on psychedelics, I've done some research on that. So, you know, you may see sounds may take the shape of a rock or something, and therefore, you know, Ugg may look like a rock, and therefore you got a name for a rock from that point on. That's one extrapolation of it, but it's all very interesting. I don't think it's hard to put kind of evidence under that exotic hypothesis, really, because we can't know what was going on in the minds and consciousness of our ancestors. There's potentially some evidence from the rock art. There's a theory by Lewis Williams and Dowson, who suggested that all Upper Paleolithic rock art, it has what we call entoptics, these geometric patterns and motifs which recur the world over in Upper Paleolithic rock art. And these motifs are indicative of altered states of consciousness, such that we see these entoptics a lot in altered states, particularly with psychedelics, but also in some people in even in just dark spaces, or through chanting or meditation, hypnosis, we or hypnagogia, we see these geometric patterns which recur in the very earliest human artwork. So there's potentially some argument there to suggest, well, this is some kind of evidence that this cultural shift we see, or this kind of the first evidence of human culture as such through art is somehow linked to the nature of going into altered states. I would say there's better evidence, though, potentially, and that is when we look at all the kind of innovations and discoveries and inventions and so on and so forth that have come about through triggers in altered states of consciousness. So like the history of dreams, for instance, we see several Nobel Prizes whereby the insight which drove the theory or discovery came through a dream. You know, Einstein's theory of relativity came through a dream. Niels Bohr's construction of the atom came through a dream. The guy, I can't remember his name, who discovered electrical conductance in nerves with frog's legs came through a dream. The invention of the sewing machine needle came through a dream, and so on and so forth. You know, Auguste Kekulé's discovery of the benzene ring came through a dream. Mendeleev's discovery of the periodic table, which preceded Kekulé's discovery of the benzene, came through a dream. And then we can see a continuity of those innovations and discoveries through psychedelics as well. So it's suggested that Francis Crick had his DNA double helix structure discovery through the consumption of LSD. Now, we don't know if that's true, because the story came after he died. We do know he did love LSD, I have that on good authority from a colleague of his. He was involved in this organization called SOMA, which was about more sensible policies around drugs and psychedelics. And he also put on masked balls, apparently, at his house with bowls of LSD punch at the door. So that was a bit of a giveaway. So, but whether or not he took it in 1953, we don't know. But we do know people like Carrie Mullis, for instance, who also won a Nobel Prize for genetic discovery, in this case, PCR, polymerase chain reaction. That came to him through his use of LSD, and we have him on record saying that. So there's a litany of discoveries, particularly in, you know, chemistry and physics and inventions and innovations and so on, coming through altered states of consciousness. So that would suggest that these are good cultural drivers, you know, they're good drivers of innovation. No doubt related to the fact that they do give you this, what we might call in psychology, diversive thinking, you know, so you kind of have greater associations of novel thoughts and, you know, you can piece things together in new ways, which you may not have thought about prior to being in that state of consciousness. I was actually involved in running a clinical drug trial with LSD with top-level scientists, with a view to looking at their creative problem-solving insights. I can't tell you anything about the results of that because they're still embargoed, other than I think they all thought they got some good insights out of it. I can't tell you anything about the actual specific quantitative results, however. So I think, you know, psychedelics and all altered states are drivers of creative problem-solving, which are drivers of at least cultural innovation and cultural growth rather than necessarily physiological evolution. But at the current time in history, you know, our cultural evolution has far surpassed our physical evolution. So that it's becoming increasingly more important, perhaps, whether or not they actually drove physiological evolution in our ancient past, they're certainly driving cultural evolution now. Just to give you some more examples, Silicon Valley, home computing industry, it's well attested that the home computing industry was largely fueled by the use of psychedelics. Steve Jobs, creator of Apple, said it was one of the most two or three important things he did was taking LSD. Bill Gates also took LSD. However, Steve Jobs said he didn't take enough or his products would have been more interesting. But there's a good book called What the Dormouse Said, which documents the use of psychedelics in the start of the home computer industry. And we also see innovations in physics as well. The fundamental physics groups were a bunch of out-of-work physics postdocs who took up theoretical physics because they couldn't get grants to do lab work. And they're also taking huge quantities of psychedelics and experimenting with parapsychology. And they developed quantum cryptography, which is now a multi-billion dollar industry. So that came out of physicists taking acid.
I read a book about those guys once, How the Hippies Saved Physics.
Exactly. Yeah, that one and What the Dormouse Said are good insights into some of the less obvious cultural drivers. We know about the influences on music and fashion and so on, but less so perhaps about the kind of scientific innovations.
Yeah. And you mentioned that dreams have historically been a source of a lot of inspiration, and I certainly have the sense, not so much in dreams, but I'll wake up with the answer to some question that I've been trying to figure out, and so maybe I did have a dream but I forgot it.
Yeah.
And there does seem to be this connection between the psychedelic state and dreams. They're kind of like dreaming awake in a way, to simplify the experience. Relating this back to evolution and perturbing our minds through psychedelics, I mean, that does seem to me to be fairly plausible, although difficult to prove. But on the other hand, there is this other side of this idea that sometimes people talk about, which I think is also interesting, and it's the idea that these plants and mushrooms themselves actually evolved to contain these compounds in order to essentially communicate these experiences to us. And so that when we consume them, it leads to us being more ecologically aware of our environment, which is, of course, of benefit to the plants. And so it's kind of a bit of an out there idea, but essentially is that there is an intelligent communication occurring on some level between our species and these plants or the rest of nature in a way. And it's a fascinating idea, and yet it does seem to be much less likely to be scientifically verifiable. But perhaps not. I don't know. Maybe you take a different view on this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the mainstream and materialistic scientific endeavour has been very much against the notion of consciousness existing beyond human beings, you know, for a long time. There was a recent committee at Cambridge University which decreed that actually, no, some mammals may be conscious. But, you know, generally, the materialist reductionist kind of scientific endeavour is not really favourable to the idea that there is any kind of intelligence anywhere in nature, although there's a huge body of research now happening demonstrating intelligence in plants, that they have memory, that they can problem solve, and so on and so forth. This can't really be ignored, I don't think. So it's, first of all, you have to kind of establish the evidence that plants can act intelligently. And then if we look a little bit more into the nature of these usually kind of plant alkaloids that are psychedelic, on occasion we have diterpenoids and things like that as well, that these kind of the kind of typical classic psychedelic alkaloids we find in plants are very, very old. They predate humans by a long, long way. They're not quite kind of a essential building blocks of life. They're what we call secondary compounds. So they've historically been around for an extremely long time. And the way in which, certainly kind of communicating with my friends who are botanists, understand these secondary compounds is that plants use them as tools of communication, either internally as in a kind of neurotransmitter or neuromodulatory way. Well, we can't talk about neurons in plants, but they, you know, plants make use for internal communications through these compounds, you know, like serotonin and so on. And also they use them for external communication with the world outside, to communicate and manipulate the exterior world. For instance, there are substances in tomatoes whereby they'll sample, if they're getting attacked by an aphid, they'll sample the saliva of the aphid and are able to identify the specific species, and then they'll release chemical pheromones to attract the specific predator for that specific species of predator for themselves. So, you know, they use these things to communicate externally for their own benefit. And so psychedelics fall into that category of substances that plants make use of. So, and it may be that they've evolved to work in various ways. There was recently, was it a kind of fungus? I can't remember what it is. There's some kind of psilocybin was found in this fungus which takes control of an ant.
I think it's cordyceps.
Cordyceps, that's it, yeah. For its own purposes. So, you know, they may be used as mind control agents for insects or for repelling insects in certain circumstances, but they may also have evolved for direct communication with other species like mammals and humans in some way. And I think it's, all right, what is the purpose of that for their benefit? That's a big question mark against that. I mean, if you look at kind of people's reports, you know, people like Paul Stamets, who's probably one of the world's leading mycologists, he would argue that psilocybin mushrooms use psilocybin directly to communicate with us and say, come on, wake up, you monkeys, you're wrecking the place. Just kind of, you're going to ruin it for everyone. You've got to just, you're part of an ecology of consciousness, and you've got to just stop this crazy ecocide, you know. So he says that they're using it on a really communicative level. Obviously, that takes us into a kind of animistic realm, but I don't think we should readily dismiss that just because it doesn't fit with some kind of constricted worldview where that kind of stuff doesn't happen. You know, that's not a good reason to kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater, really. I think we should approach these things open-mindedly, you know. We genuinely are in some kind of ecological crisis, and, you know, psychedelics do seemingly, on face value, communicate with us and alert us to those kind of issues and make us more ecologically orientated. I've done some research with the survey and found that, you know, psychedelics were great drivers of eco-consciousness. I found that 100% of people in my survey said they felt more connected to nature from their psychedelic experiences. most of them were also more concerned because of their psychedelic experiences. It also kind of reflected in their behavioral changes. So the majority of people said they had changed their diet as a result of their psychedelic experiences, you know, to be more vegan or local or vegetarian or whatever, or organic. Over 50%, the majority had also said they'd increased the amount of gardening they do as a result of taking psychedelics, you know. So, and even a small percentage, like 16%, changed their careers to one that was more ecologically orientated. To give an example, two people gave up what they were doing and took up PhDs in botany specifically because they'd tripped once and they were like, oh my God, we've got to do something about this, you know. So I think they are, the evidence would suggest, at least whether or not we maintain an animist perspective on these things, that they do change attitudes and behavior in a more kind of biospheric way, you know, towards the whole kind of planet, not just to the specific species that are kind of making us trip, but also those, you know. Certainly the existence of psilocybin containing mushrooms is probably rapidly developed, you know, as a consequence of them being psychedelic. You know, there's people growing them in their droves.
It's serving them quite well, isn't it?
Yeah, serving them pretty well, I would say, whatever the nature of animism or not. But, you know, I think we should keep an open mind to those kind of interpretations as well.
Yeah. So let's move on slightly to these sort of transpersonal dimensions of psychedelics, which I know that you're very interested in. And so psychedelic states definitely seem to have these transpersonal aspects which extend beyond the individual. And, of course, there's a lot of debate about what psychedelics might reveal, if anything, about reality. But you suggested that we could potentially test these apparent extended mind aspects of psychedelic states essentially through psi experiments, such as looking for evidence of telepathy or precognition. And I know that you've actually done some of your own research in this area, and I'd really love to get into what you found out. But let me start out by asking you why it is that you think that psi and other parapsychological phenomena like this could have some scientific merit. What would you say to someone, maybe a scientist, who wasn't at all aware that there was any legitimate scientific research in this area to base this on?
Yeah, so, I mean, there was a brilliant article recently in the, is it American Psychologist? Or kind of the flagship kind of magazine journal of the American Psychological Association. Last year by a colleague of mine, Professor Edsel Cardenia, and he basically just gave a really nice overview of the state of the art in parapsychology. And, you know, there's 10 distinct research paradigms, which the meta-analyses all show that there are highly significant positive effects indicating that psi is a genuine phenomena. And that constitutes hundreds and hundreds of individual research studies, all kind of collated and meta-analyzed and so on. So, you know, look at the data, first of all. I think we've got to the point where there is kind of a substantial body of data which seems to indicate that psi is a genuine phenomenon. Genuine, I say, but albeit very weak. The effect sizes are not huge. These are kind of quite small effect sizes. But when you do enough research, they appear to be quite robust. Obviously, individual experiments don't always return positive results, but across the whole scheme of things, you get very good trends, which are significant. And it also shows that psi is seemingly largely an unconscious phenomenon as well. So it happens, it's a subtle process, not least in its effects, but also in the level of awareness we have of it. So most people, we may all be kind of have psychic capacities, but we're not really consciously aware of that most of the time. And that's why some of the biggest effects come through altered states of consciousness. So people in dreams or meditative states and so on and so forth seem to be more receptive, perhaps because this information is typically mediated cognitively through the, you know, unconscious processes. So there's a sense in which altered states of consciousness give us access to this unconscious material, this more kind of symbolic and non-linear associative kind of material that we see in dreams, wherein the message, somehow the information transfer of psi makes itself apparent. So alt states are a good starting block to explore this. And I think we do have good evidence to suggest that it should be taken seriously.
Right. And psi here essentially meaning telepathy, for example, precognition, maybe mind-matter interaction, although I realise that's more controversial. But essentially psi being an umbrella term for maybe five different sensitivities that have been identified that humans apparently have. And you mentioned that the effect sizes are very small, but of course, you know, small effects can have huge implications, especially if they don't, if they fundamentally don't fit with our view of reality. And so I think if psi is real and our minds do, in a sense, extend beyond our bodies, then it is very natural to think that psychedelics would amplify these kinds of phenomena, especially given how profoundly transpersonal these experiences seem to be and how much of the unconscious seems to be unveiled. So is there much history of using psychedelics to study psi?
To some extent. I mean, I'll say just to put some data under that hypothesis that, you know, psychedelics seem to induce these experiences more. You can see, like, from survey research myself and others have conducted, that, you know, people do report a lot of these experiences under the influence of psychedelics. You know, so something like 50% of my sample who had taken psychedelics said they'd had an experience of telepathy while under the influence. And you don't really see that on non-psychedelic drugs. You know, something like 2% of the people on non-psychedelic drugs had an experience of telepathy under the influence. So there's something specific about psychedelics, which is probably this access to the unconscious material, which at least drives the experience of psi. Now, we don't know for certain, though, those experiences are genuine, of course, until we do some experimental research and we can rule out alternative explanations. And that's where we need to do more research, basically. I mean, there were a number of experiments conducted, mostly in the 50s and 60s. So some by parapsychologists experimenting with psychedelics and some by psychedelic researchers dabbling in parapsychology. And there was a lot of overlap in these two fields of research back in the 1960s. And then, of course, Prohibition came along and two different areas of research were kind of suitably kind of put off by Prohibition, that neither of them wanted to be seen to be tarnishing their reputation by researching the other field, you know. So, you know, parapsychologists and psychedelic researchers kind of went their separate ways when Prohibition occurred in the late 60s. And it hasn't really kind of been reunited since. So it's fair to say I'm probably one of the only researchers currently who's actually looking at kind of parapsychological phenomena with psychedelics. And so there's a huge hiatus in research that's been done. The research that was done in the 60s, unfortunately, the scientific kind of standards of methodology in those days wasn't particularly rigorous. So although they showed some promising results, it's not really very evidential because, you know, they didn't have control conditions in a lot of cases. You didn't have placebos, which is problematic anyway in psychedelic research. So they didn't have any kind of benchmarks to gauge them against. The kind of sometimes they didn't have use of statistics and so on and so forth. So that early research isn't really evidential. And so I've been kind of forced to conduct my own experiments to try and address this question. Forced to.
Yeah, so I understand that you have done some research looking at psi and psychedelic states, and I understand that the first experiments didn't go exactly as you had initially planned. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, there's no such thing as a failed experiment, really, because you learn something from doing it. That's the point of experimentation, and I learned that my methodology wasn't really suitable to the task. So I initially started off by doing precognition experiments with people in ayahuasca ceremonies, and actually found that people's precognition scores dropped when they're under the influence of ayahuasca or shortly afterwards.
Maybe a bit distracted.
Well, not so much that. There was a control condition as well, and the scores also dropped in the control condition, which tells you you've got an order effect and that there's something wrong with your methodology, basically. So it's not that, oh, this is evidence that people aren't precognitive under the influence of ayahuasca. It's just that the methodology isn't clearly suitable. And there's various reasons for that. I won't go into the technical details, but so I adapted my methodology to one more conducive, I think, to this kind of research, and tried to replicate or try to kind of continue the research, but this time with San Pedro cactus, which is a mescaline-containing cactus from South America. In the end, I was attempting to, again, recruit 20 people to the experimental condition and have them do a trial each. That wasn't feasible in the time I had traveling around Ecuador, largely because it was like a wild goose chase trying to find shamans who would let you kind of do this kind of research in their ceremonies. And I ended up just doing a self-experimentation instead, because I had all the protocol. And I did all 20 trials myself. And under, you know, very well-controlled conditions, came up with nice, significant results. So obviously, I don't think this is hugely evidential, because this is just one person and one experiment. But it is kind of proof of process that this methodology has some utility. I've since done the experiment again with people under the influence of LSD. I can't really say anything about that particularly, because again, I haven't published the paper. Well, I can say that I got a significant result in the opposite direction, which was intriguing and baffling in equal measure, which seems to suggest that it's not like there's no evidence of psi. There is evidence of psi, but it's a kind of evidence of a psi blocking, if you like. And that's because I think my participant pool were scientists who weren't particularly open to the notion of psi. So I didn't take a measure, unfortunately, of their beliefs.
Bit of a sheep-goat effect.
Exactly. So we do know from previous research that the sheep-goat effect, where, you know, believers tend to score well in psi tests, and non-believers actually don't. It's not like they don't score well, it's that they tend to score in the opposite direction. But I was using kind of very materialist scientists, and they managed to get a significant missing score, which was, you know, quite unlikely, you know, statistically, just like from random chance. I think it's probably a genuine effect, which shows that they were applying their unconscious processes, perhaps, to not get a good score in the task. Right. So, you know, scientists are not good participants for this kind of research. That's the conclusion from that. And I'm now attempting to do some further experiments with people, psychonauts this time, under the influence of DMT. But I haven't got all the data in yet, so I can't say any further than that.
And I'm keen to get into your DMT research, but just to one question arises for me on this. When you do see, or if you do see, positive psi effects during a psychedelic psi experiment, how do you differentiate this psi effect in psychedelics from what might be people's innate psi abilities, assuming that we have them?
That's a good question. So this is problematic as well. And this also kind of somewhat identifies the psi psychedelic research avenue as somewhat redundant in effect anyway, because we know from the evidence, or at least what the evidence seems to suggest, is that, you know, people can be psychic in various states of consciousness anyway. We seem to find, you know, association with altered states tends to improve it. You know, belief seems to be a factor, and so on and so forth. But we've got enough evidence from people not on psychedelics that they can do well on psi tasks, right, as a group. So kind of asking, well, do we get these effects with psychedelics is kind of, well, we get them anyway, right? So you're kind of forced to have a control group. I have had some control conditions, but it's very difficult to have truly blind conditions in this context. So I did a matched pairs with the ayahuasca study. I did a before and after with the LSD. They scored a chance before LSD and significantly psi missing on LSD. And in my own self-experimentation, I, of course, did a control condition where I wasn't under the influence of mescaline. However, that's not a blind control, because I knew I wasn't under the influence of mescaline, and that was a chance. So it's very difficult to have a true blinded condition in this context. I will say that the LSD subjects were blinded, but it becomes apparent fairly quickly, although not as quick as you'd think, if you happen to be under the influence of a psychedelic. Actually, in our case, it took quite a while for the participants to realize they were tripping, especially if they'd never taken psychedelics before. But it's very difficult to have a true blind condition. So that leads you to the alternative is that people are intentionally trying to do worse on the side task in the control condition, right? But that then also kind of calls into play, well, how can you intentionally be not psychic, right? In a task which is completely randomized, which kind of suggests there is evidence of psi, but we can't be certain to what degree the psychedelics are instrumental in that. So it's slightly problematic, and I'm not sure how easily that problem will go away, but I think it's worth just getting some data down on this anyway.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that if psi is a real phenomenon, then there is a strong intuition that the sort of transpersonal states of psychedelics should lead us in that direction. But I'm slightly conscious of the time ticking away, and I do want us to get into DMT. So I know that you focus your research specifically on DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which I understand is potentially the most powerful psychedelic that we know of. But apart from that, what is it to you that is distinctive and interesting about this molecule?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about DMT, apart from the intensity of the experience, which, you know, as I said earlier, can make atheists non-atheists in 10 minutes, is that it's naturally occurring not just in various plants, but also in pretty much all mammals, as far as we know, including humans. So here we have a psychedelic agent which is naturally occurring in the human body, and we don't know necessarily what the function of that is, although there's been a lot of speculation, or even where it's produced, for that matter. But it is potentially a jigsaw piece in the puzzle of how spontaneous mystical and transpersonal experiences and parapsychological experiences arise. It could be that, you know, endogenous DMT that's made in the body could be part of the equation of how spontaneous experiences occur. And so that, for me, is probably one of the main reasons for studying it. But also, and I think it's probably because it is endogenous, it also has these extremely profound effects on people. I mean, life-changing, kind of worldview-changing, kind of atheist-changing effects.
So, as you know, one of the very common experiences during psychedelics, and especially DMT, though, are these very convincing encounters with apparent intelligences, which seem to be originating from outside of us somehow. They seem very other to us, and yet I know that you're open to the idea, among other possibilities, that these experiences could be legitimate encounters with other beings, other minds potentially inhabiting different frames of reality on some level. So what is it that makes that a plausible idea for you?
Well, it's something that people tend to come away from the experience thinking, you know. People go into a DMT experience maybe not really knowing what to expect, or maybe having read some stuff, but you can't really prepare somebody for a DMT experience because it's beyond our realm of understanding, you know, in the ordinary state of consciousness. So people are genuinely kind of deeply surprised and kind of somewhat awestruck by the intensity of the experience. And encounters with seemingly sentient other beings occurs pretty frequently at high doses. And of course, one of the things about the DMT experience is that it seemed more real than waking reality. You know, if you had to kind of hedge your ontological bets on which reality was more real, most people would put it on the DMT experience. And hence it's kind of profoundly worldview changing capacities. So the experience alone leads people to accept the experiences often at face value, that they really did encounter otherworldly beings that exist in some other kind of disincarnate realm or some such. aside from that, I mean, so we shouldn't necessarily just dismiss people's experiences because they're subjective. But also one of the other features is that there's often a high degree of correspondence between people's experiences, perhaps even naively. So that, for instance, there are certain characters which seem to pop up with alarming recurrency, like the little people, for instance. So, you know, the experience of encounters with dwarves, elves, pixies, gnomes, whatever you want to call them, little people seems to occur quite a lot. And we also know these experiences were relatively common pre the discovery of DMT. You know, people would spontaneously have encounters with little people, we know from folklore the world over. So that's an intriguing experience, as are some other kind of more obscure kind of characters, such as praying mantises, typically conducting, like usually huge praying mantises towering over the person, conducting kind of brain surgery on people and kind of rearranging their kind of neural makeup. This is what people report. Even people I've known naively have had these experiences and then were astonished to discover, oh no, that happens quite a lot. And then there are other kind of perhaps archetypal DMT motifs as well that recur. So why is it, you know, how do we kind of understand this from a reductionist point of view? Why should so many people seemingly independently have an encounter with a kind of giant praying mantis doing kind of brain surgery on them? Is there some kind of, you know, node in the brain which is triggered by DMT, which is specifically designed to induce these kinds of experiences? That seems very unlikely. One of the caveats, of course, is, though, that you can't ever have a completely culturally unmediated experience. There's no such thing. So it's hard to know what kind of cultural influences or baggage or prior knowledge or memes a person brings to an experience like a DMT experience. You know, perhaps they're vaguely aware of elves, you know. Maybe that if they've read some Terence McKenna, for sure they knew about the elves. But some of the other characters are more obscure and still pop up with a high degree of recurrence when you might not necessarily expect that, because there's not so much kind of cultural information out there about them. Ultimately, though, it's impossible to kind of pass the experience from people's cultural influences. So it's very difficult to kind of establish the genuine nature of these things merely from people's experiences alone, even if they do have a high degree of similarity among seemingly independent experiences.
We certainly have dreams where we appear to interact with other intelligences. So what are the reasons to consider this might be different to that?
This is a good question, actually. I mean, I think something to do with the astonishing nature of it and the recurrence of particular identities of particular characters. You know the occurrence of elves, for instance, in dreams is probably fairly evenly distributed or fairly random. You know, the recurrence of elves in DMT experiences is extremely prolific. So that's kind of a good question mark there. It's also, people don't tend to wake up from dreams going, oh my God, that was more real than this real. So there's another kind of question mark there. And obviously there may be something inherent in DMT which gives rise to that. But I think we should also try and approach this open-mindedly. It's ultimately a largely metaphysical question, but I think there are ways in which we could attempt to approach this empirically as well, although it's not easy to get at. But I mean, who's to say that dreams aren't also some that have a degree of their own internal reality too? When people have shared dream experiences or precognitive dreams, which tend to occur more than you would expect by chance alone, then how do we understand these? And we even have kind of lab data to back up with evidence for the genuine existence of dream precognition or telepathy as well, which seems to suggest a kind of extended mind model of consciousness. So if we at least have as a working hypothesis the notion of an extended mind, then is it potentially feasible that people are having encounters with other than themselves in these experiences? It's a big open question.
Yeah. Has there been much sort of mainstream research or attempts to explain this phenomenon of encountering intelligent entities? For example, you know, is there any proposed brain-based story for what brings these experiences about? Because, I mean, just like the default mode network has this relatively specialized process for shaping our sense of self, it seems plausible to me that there is like a relatively specialized area in the brain which kind of flicks on when we're dealing with other intelligences, because, you know, the moment that there are other intelligences in our vicinity, then we kind of have to shift gears to start anticipating what these other minds might be up to. And so if a psychedelic is disrupting this intelligence identifier or intentionality projecting process, then it could create the perception of other intelligences trying to communicate with us. And since our minds are already in this very open individualist perspective that psychedelics put us into, you know, maybe that is why the apparent messages that are coming from these entities have these very distinct overtones of oneness and connection. And I realize that doesn't explain some of the weirder experiences, though.
I mean, possibly not. I think it's an interesting point you kind of made there, perhaps maybe not directly, but it's like if there is a part of the brain which is somehow associated with encounters with other, you know, like a communication part of the brain or identification of faces or other beings or something like that, which is activated during these encounters on DMT, that doesn't necessarily solve the issue, does it? Because as you said, it could be that if you're having an encounter with some other being, be it, you know, genuinely in the real world or in a DMT experience, you would expect those part of the brain to be activated. And there is research going on. I'm collaborating with the team at Imperial, primarily Chris Timmerman, who's working with DMT. So we're looking at brain imaging and DMT experiences. But it still becomes either a neurotheological or a theoneurological kind of debate, right? Okay, of course, these parts of the brain are activated when you're having encounters. But is it they're activated because you're having an encounter, or are you having an encounter because this part of the brain is activated? You see, it becomes a bit of a chicken in the egg kind of debate, really. But it's still useful data to kind of determine, okay, so what is actually happening in the brain when these encounter experiences occur? And Chris has just completed his first fMRI scanning of people on DMT and asked them about their entity encounters. So we'll have some data on that soon, or he will at least. But then we're going to collaborate in the next few years, hopefully, on some more kind of exotic questions as well. Ultimately, how you interpret the data really depends on your prior position on what the experiences mean. Let's see what data we come up with, though, anyway.
Okay, David, well, we've exhausted all of our time that we have together, but I think that the research that you're working on is really exciting and interesting, and I'm sure that we could find things to talk about for much longer. But before we wrap things up here, where should people go if they want to find out more about your work and your ideas?
So I've got a few books out there. The one from last year, Other Worlds, Psychedelics and Exceptional Experience, gives a good overview of this kind of research area, and more specifically to do with DMT and DMT entities. We had a book out last year called DMT Dialogues, which has like about 20 of the kind of world's major thinkers on this topic all come together to discuss DMT entities. So either of those books are a good resource, or you can find me on academia.edu as well for all my papers.
Is there anything else that you have coming up that you'd like people to know about?
Well, Breaking Convention, of course. It's a conference that I co-organise at the University of Greenwich. It happens every 2 years. It's on again this year in August, 16th to the 18th of August. We have over 150 speakers from around the world talking about psychedelic consciousness from every angle, you know, psychiatry, philosophy, therapy, you name it. And that's a great event. Do come along and find out more. Breaking Convention, 16th to the 18th of August.
I'll make sure that there is a link to that in the description, and I'll try and make it there myself. I'll put some links in to the books as well.
That'd be great. Please do submit a paper and come and give a presentation. That'd be great.
Maybe. Well, again, David, thanks so much for making time for me and having this conversation on Waking Cosmos. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks so much, Adrian.
Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed today's episode of Waking Cosmos, exploring the mystery of consciousness and its place in reality. Remember that you can help keep the lights on here at Waking Cosmos by supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/wakingcosmos. Okay, my friends, I will see you next time for more episodes exploring consciousness, reality, and life's place in the universe. I'm Adrian Nelson. Until next time.